Hey, welcome to the Pratfalls Podcast, a show that features conversations with people who do creative work about their work and their lives. I'm your host, Levi Weinhagen. You can find me on Twitter at ThatLevi. This episode is my conversation with writer David Roth, and I'm just going to up top say it was recorded on a phone call, so the audio quality is not the normal stellar quality you've all come to love and expect from the Pratfalls Podcast. But it was what fit and worked out with some scheduling things, and I was just really excited to get to talk to David. And he is terrific and had a lot of great things to share, and I think you'll appreciate it. So I think, you know, listen for a minute or two. You will adjust to the phone call sound and get right into it. A few things I'll also mention. David references some articles he's worked on and a few videos that he talked about, and I put links to some of those things on the website. So if you go to pratfallspod.com, you can find links to Olympic video that he's mentioned, some of his writing. Check those things out. But also follow him on Twitter. He's sharing work all the time, and it is really, really good. If this is your first time listening to Pratfalls Podcast, please note there's a bunch of other great episodes with artists and creative folks from all walks of life. Go to pratfallspod.com or just subscribe on iTunes. And if you want to rate and review the show, give a 5-star rating. That will make me very happy. I will thank you in a future episode. It's a win-win. Okay, enough nonsense. Now let's get into this fun, sincere, and interesting conversation with David Roth.
So you're David Roth. I know that much. And from everything I can see, you are a tried and true writer. Like, that you self-identify as a writer, and that is your craft and your job and all the various parts. Is that an accurate representation?
Yeah, I mean, I do more editing than writing right now, although I think that balance is sort of shifting. It's constantly shifting, but yeah, that's, writing is what I started out doing, and it's the thing that I'm probably best at.
Yeah.
Like, of all tasks.
Well, so I want to do, the reason I reached out to you is, I mean, because of your writing. So I want to do like a upfront confession thing.
All right.
I don't watch sports generally. Like, I'm not a
totally
I played
reasonable
a lot play. Of sports in high school, and I'm not someone who watches a lot of sports. But I absolutely love sports journalism. It is some of my favorite writing. I like to consume things that talk about the people who play the sports and the people who make the things happen. I think there's a lot of
how does that work for you? If you don't watch, how does the writing resonate for you?
Well, you have to be a good writer. What I realize is it means I really like good writing. And a good writer, and some of the things I see in your writing, is you are describing the emotional context of an event that I otherwise don't care about. So I can watch somebody play a game, and it's not that entertaining to me, with some exceptions. Like something like American Ninja Warrior, I actually enjoy watching.
That's the one that I think is the it's the gateway sport for pretty much everybody. My wife was a dancer, never played sports, and could not be more obsessed with that show. It's a miracle. Anyway, but go ahead. So finish what you're saying.
That's exactly it. So, like, I do physical comedy, and to me, American Ninja Warrior is just always on the cusp of physical comedy, but it's also beautiful and brilliant. So what I was getting at is I think the challenge of sports writing and why I like it when it works out is you have to create an image in my brain of the thing that happened, which seems really easy. Like, this guy did this thing at this time, but then you also have to say why it matters and why it would matter to that specific person, but also why it matters to you as a viewer and why it might matter to the people who are emotionally connected to this particular team or this particular sport, and all of that in about 3 sentences. And so I really love that sort of conciseness that you have to do that well, because you also usually don't have a lot of space. Although, you know, some of your projects, like the classical, you can take up more space if you want to, but I think you're still pretty tight with that. So all of this is to say, I'm curious about how much going into writing about sports you were aware of needing to do that much. Like, did it start with you just loved sports and wanted to be connected to it? Or did you love writing and this sort of thing
start
you
out.
Love, so you wrote about it? So, like, how did you get to
the idea of writing about sports? I came to through, I mean, I always cared about it. It came and went, you know, throughout. Like, I was in middle school, it was obsessive. basketball fan, and before that baseball, and then, you know, but, and, you know, and I played all the sports, but the, yeah, but like, I found it easier to, I pitched pitcher stuff, a lot of politics stuff, I wrote a lot of those things. Sports was the sort of thing where it was easier for me to get my pitches taken, and I think I was just better at it than I was at the other stuff. I don't have any real, you know, pretense to expertise in any of it. Like, you know, I don't know, I'm not like sourced in a way that some of your better sports writers are, where they're like, you know, getting a text message from some agent who's telling them what's actually going on. Like, I'm watching TV too, like, guessing at the shit. But it's the, you know, and I just use a lot of adjectives to paper over the fact that I'm an idiot. And that's the secret to the whole thing. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of with that, I mean, I find it easier to write about sports in some ways than to write about other stuff because it's, or, you know, than to write about something like politics or to write about, you know, a movie or whatever. Because at this point, I'm now, like, you know, given that I'm writing columns and less, you know, featurey, reportery stuff, like, I'm really writing about my experience of watching the thing. And so connecting it into the context in which I'm watching it, you know, which is never just this sort of, like, couch in a vacuum, you know, that, like, the thing I wrote about American Ninja Warrior, the last column I wrote about it, and this is going to sound so ridiculous, said to somebody that did not read the column, it's going to seem like such a preposterous reach. I mean, it was like flipping back and forth between the Republican convention and American Ninja Warrior. And just,
yeah,
you know, but sunshine and darkness, like the, just in terms of the vision of things, I mean, beyond any partisan element of it. I mean, it's like all this constant, you know, drumbeat of like, they're coming, they're going to kill you, they want your kids, whatever. And then you just go to the other one and it's everybody just sort of screaming happily while these weirdos scramble through some impossibly sadistic sci-fi obstacle course. And it's like, you know, that's not actually the vision that we have. I mean, it's like, it's technocratic liberalism and whatever it is that's on Trump's mind at the moment. Like, it's not, there's no draw there. It's just, you know, I can write about how that made me feel and about how I felt watching it and how I felt thinking about it. And my bosses are nice enough to just sort of let me do that instead of insisting that I do something with any merit. So that's good. That's the secret. You got to have people that will let you write stupid shit if you want to make it.
That's a good quote.
Yeah, I appreciate it. The, I think with the, but in general, I think with writing about sports, like there's, you know, there's a context to it, you know, that is as rich and as large as you sort of want it to be. I mean, it can be just about a game, but then it can also be about that team and that industry, you know, individual player on the team and where that player finds him or herself. And that's really cool because it opens up a bunch of stuff that you're not writing about. It's not like a fixed object that exists to be sort of like either analyzed within the context that it creates for itself or that's been created for it. Like, it is 300 million different ways to watch it, you know, and so you just have to pick the one that you, that suits you best.
Yeah, well, and there's something profound. So I, this past weekend, I happened to be with a friend of mine who's from Puerto Rico on Saturday when Puerto Rico won its first ever gold medal in the Olympics. And tennis is great. Like, that can be an entertaining thing, but I don't have any connection to it. But being with him and watching him be on Twitter while Puerto Rico is winning their first gold medal, like, it was incredibly emotional and powerful, but it's because I knew all this context of how passionate Puerto Ricans are about their island and about the culture and their culture getting out in the world and being represented. And so if I didn't know any of that stuff, it would have just been like, a lady won a tennis match. Who cares?
Yeah. But it's weird. I mean, it was so much about, like, you know, they never won, whatever. And like, Puerto Rico is really going through it right now. Like, it is a terrible time on that island. And I guess it's not, you know, it's not your job if you're calling a tennis match, you know, that, like, they want to declare bankruptcy and Congress won't let them or whatever. I mean, obviously, it's like, stick to sports at that point. But yeah, that's, it was emotional for me to watch it. Connection to that, really.
Yeah. And I think I want that anytime if I'm watching sports. That's why I'm not that engaged in watching it, is I need to be with somebody who's diehard passionate about the thing that I'm watching for it to matter. So I think that's why I like to read writing about it. Like, your writing is, as you touched on, it's pretty much always autobiography. Like, it can't not be, because you're talking about your experience of the thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes that I should back off of that. And I like not being that way. I mean, I've written a lot of stuff that's really more like featurey in the past. It's just that this is the job that I've sort of defaulted to over the last year. And I look forward to writing stuff that is not as autobiographical. I mean, I get kind of bored with myself and my own, like, I feel like I've told my, and I feel like I've told the same stories about, like, the New Jersey Nets making me sad, you know, a dozen times for, like, five different venues at this point.
Yeah.
You know, I'm blessed that nobody actually reads them, so they always come off fresh for a new crop of readers. But it's, like, it's weird. I mean, like, there's that element of it. It's nice in terms of getting me into it, you know, in terms of finding my own way into the story, but I've always had that in terms of editing my own writing, that a lot of times I'll have to go back and just like lop the first two paragraphs off the top when I'm going back over it, because those are these sort of almost like apologetic sort of paragraphs about being like, how weird is it that I'm writing about sports, like, you know, with global warming and all that. I know it's crazy. Anyway, like, humor me for a minute and blah, blah. And they're like, but that's not necessary, you know, and then I can just sort of go back. That's like me writing my way into, it's like a warm up for actually writing the thing that I'm going to write. And it's, you know, there's something about it that's kind of like, if I think we're sticking more closely to the thing that I'm actually supposed to be writing about. Like, if the story about Amari Stoudemire was really, if I were capable of just making it about Amari Stoudemire, I think it would probably be an easier lift. But I don't know. I guess in some ways I let myself do it because I think the stuff is richer when I'm bringing more of my own experience to it. But I don't know if it's richer for, you know.
Well, and as a writer, he doesn't exist outside of you. Like, that's part of the weird narcissism of being a human that no one is.
I guess I shouldn't kick myself around for not reconciling that, given that no human being has ever successfully reconciled that particular quirk of being alive.
You're painfully aware of it, is all. That's what you're.
That's like as close as we've ever gotten to, like, you know, like really having some sort of in context understanding of our own experiences. Like, but it's weird though with especially, you know, writing about the NBA Finals. And writing about LeBron last year too, that there is this constant attempt to sort of like taxonomize and to create these like pantheons and sub pantheons and to constantly be moving players around in them in terms of, are they a tier one immortal or are they a mere demigod or are they whatever? And I find that insanely tiresome, but also there's this like pretense, like this like scientific attempt at like being, you know, like crunching some sort of numbers and coming up with, you know, this thing that is like the superstar index or whatever, that this is like some sort of goal of a lot of sports writing, and I really don't find that fun. I think it's inevitably not very illuminating either, but that there's something about that impulse is one that I think that if I can justify like writing about it from a more like aesthetic or humanistic perspective, it's that, like, I want to stay as far away from that instinct as I possibly can.
Yeah, that's a really interesting area to me, in that most sports have, unlike a lot of parts of our lives, some hard and fast numbers. So you can do some actual data crunching of this person had the most of blank. But also, it seems like there's no true way to determine the best of a certain thing. So that argument and debate goes on forever.
Yeah.
And it's almost, there's all this constant to just, the same way the athletes are trying to all be the best at whatever they're doing, the people who are telling the stories of those athletes are also trying to declare somebody the best of whatever the thing is. And I don't know are those two holding each other up? Like, do they need each other to exist to be?
See, I think not, but I think that a lot of writers do default to that. I think, and I understand it. I think that, but to me, there's always been this difference. It, you know, the sports are, you know, there's a guy, a writer that I used to work with who had a blog back when people had blogs. It was called Sports is a TV Show. And I think that that's the way that we can think of it, that these are characters and that this is a story and whatever. And like, but they're also, you know, they're independent people within that. Like, it matters a great deal to LeBron James to win an NBA championship in Cleveland. I understand that. And I understand why it would mean a great deal to him. It does not mean nearly as much to me because, and this performance in the finals, the same way that I found last year's performance, which he had just for that don't care about this, but like, it was, you know, a team that was incredible. Two players were injured by the time the first game of the finals ended. And he pretty much single-handedly won two games for his team against this total juggernaut Warriors team just by, like, playing in a way that, like, it was totally graceless. It's not really his style of play at all, but he just did everything. And there was something very inspiring about it. And I think that that performance is no less profound, or I think is maybe even more memorable because the team lost. I mean, like, you know, for him, he wants as many rings as Michael Jordan. He wants, you know, that, and that's fine. If that's what motivates him, then that's great. But for me, like, I have a different experience of it, and I am asking for different things from the experience. Like, I'm looking at it the same way that I would listen to a piece of music or look at a piece of art or whatever. That's like, I'm looking for an experience. I'm looking to feel some feelings. And, you know, the outcome of it matters to a certain extent in that, but it's not going to ever matter as much to me as it's going to matter to the people competing in it.
So I really like that. I mean, that's such an artistic approach to even viewing, watching any sort of sports or watching any kind of competition thing.
It also makes it easier to watch, right? Because you don't actually need to know what's going on. If you're getting some emotion from it, then if you're getting some response, then, like, it's working for you. You don't need to understand the entire history of the context or, like, have watched a bunch of, like, beach volleyball in your life.
Well, that's funny that, I mean, you just wrote a piece about the Olympics that I think is saying a lot of that. There was a line I actually wrote down where you said, the abstraction of watching a game you don't understand, and then the baseline weirdness of that is accentuated and sharpened by the fundamental challenge of watching greatness in action. So I think that the Olympic thing is it's people who have gotten there by being amazing in a field of people who are amazing. And it is often really, like, bizarre sports that even people who will love sports are like, I don't watch this kind of horse-based events very often.
I'm sure that horse is dancing very well, and yet, yeah.
It's somewhat compelling. So I think there is a disorienting beauty just because to watch anyone who's amazing at something do their thing is suddenly interesting, even if you have zero interest in that thing most of the time.
Yeah.
It feels different.
Yeah. To me, the Olympics is the ultimate in that. The viewership, I mean, the whole approach that NBC has reflects that they understand that, like, a hugely disproportionate relative to usual sports numbers, like, much more of the audience is female, much more of them are older. It's really a different demo. And to a certain extent, it can be corny when you watch it because they're clearly, like, reaching for that human interest hook. And there's almost this, you know, Ryan Seacrest walking around for some reason. Like, it's all got that kind of, like, glossy TV element to it. And yet, like, if you can hook into that, I mean, the struggle of it is easier for me to understand the greatness of it. Like, to watch, like, Katie would swim half a length of a pool faster than anybody else. Like, I'm not, you know, I can see it. I know it's awesome. But, like, I couldn't exactly tell you what, you know, is going on with it. And my dad, who was a swimmer in high school and still swims, was telling me that he had watched the men's 1500 final, which is literally these guys swimming a mile flat out. And he was saying, who won it by, you know, nearly at a world record time, won it by 15. My dad was like, that guy's form was terrible. I was sure that he was going to bomb out, that he's twisting, he's all over the place, he's not doing all the things that, like, coaches tell you to do. And the guy nearly broke a world record for swimming a mile faster than anyone has swum a mile.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I miss the fine points of that. And with the Olympics, I think, and I probably miss the fine points of it watching a baseball or a basketball game, you know, games that I played all my life, that I've watched all my life. And I'm not exactly, you know, I don't hold myself out as being, like, able to scout players or able to really pick up tendencies. Like, I can tell when a curveball's good, but mostly because somebody just swung at it and missed it by, you know, 90 seconds. Like, with something like this, though, I mean, there's something, if you lean into it, like, and you just sort of are like, all right, that looks insanely cool. Like, I mean, that's, if I could watch gymnastics without the scoring, I think I would enjoy it just as much. I'd probably
maybe more. Yeah.
Yeah. Because so much of it is afterwards, you know, you go back and the guy's sort of frantically trying to explain to you, poor Tim Daggett, excitable ass Tim Daggett on NBC, is trying to, like, tell you sort of why this happened or, you know, but, like, they can't do it in 60 seconds. And they also know that, like, nobody fundamentally cares. Like, if it was just an opportunity to watch people, like, flip around and do crazy stuff, like, I would for sure watch that more than, like, the metal stuff doesn't necessarily resonate to me very much either. Again, I mean, that's for the athletes.
Yeah, I mean, if I watch a parkour video, I don't need a score for me to find that amazing and strange and
delightful. Yeah, do people score stuff like that?
I don't. I'm sure the MTV found a way to make it into a X Games thing.
We have some of our best people on it, I'm sure.
Yeah, we're trying to figure out a way to monetize this running in the street game.
The more closer we can come to quantifying all forms of expression, the better off I think all of us will be.
I agree. I think that's a good way to go. Well, so in the area of quantifying, I'm going to pretend this is a good segue. You are the co-founder of this platform, The Classical, which is a sports writing site. I don't know what the right word is. And I'd love to hear about the sort of idea behind starting that. But first, what I'm going to ask you about is how that connects to your decisions around money as a writer, which is, with a few glaring exceptions, a hardscrabble career to actually make money from. I mean, you said you're doing more editing than writing these days.
I have a day job these days. You know, I'm lucky with that. Like, I'm paid every 2 weeks by Vice, and that's great. But The Classical, I was not in that position when we started it. I mean, it's like 5 years old now. And it's, you know, it's changed a bunch of times, and I think it's really downshifting in terms of, you know, what it is, and because so many of the people that were there when we started it have moved on to other jobs, myself included.
Out of necessity, right? Like,
what's that?
Partially out of necessity, not just we hate.
Yeah, oh, for sure. I mean, The Classical was never a money-making concern. You know, we raised money from Kickstarter to get the infrastructure built, and the original idea was that we were going to pay ourselves to edit and write, and then we were going to figure out some other way to make money later on. You know, there were like ads on it for a while, which, you know, from which I think we probably made a grand total of $110 over 5 years or some shit, the way that you do with web ads. You know, which I think is, nobody even knows how to make money on that. You know, the Times can't make money. And it's not going to be like 8 freelance people like part-timing their way through some sort of appreciation of a pro wrestler or whatever. You know, like that's not, it's not, that was not surprisingly a secret revenue opportunity untapped by Silicon Valley and investment bankers. We did it because I think all of us at that point were, I mean, everybody was in sort of different parts of their career in different phases of it. I think everybody wanted to work together and it seemed like a fun thing to do. And I think that, you know, there's a bunch of like stages in my mind that I think of The Classical as having existed, and I will not bore you and anyone listening with, you know, what they actually are. But there was a 1 year period where we were doing magazines basically, or as like a sort of a special, people could subscribe to it and they would show up on your iPad or whatever. There's an app. And those were great and I loved working on them. And those were really hard. I mean, I think that it was a lot of work. The pieces, we actually paid for those, but I paid people out of my own pocket. I was working at SB Nation at the time and I had money. But it was a lot of, you know, for a sideline thing or for like a hobby, that's a lot of stuff. You know, it goes beyond not being a moneymaker at that point to being like, you know, the reason why I'm staying up until 2 a.m. editing. And you know, but I love doing it and I still love doing it. You know, I mean, I still love all the bad habits that I picked up. I was a freelancer, you know, writer for 5 years and for 5 straight years. And I had periods before that where I was doing it and I really didn't know what I was doing. And to say that I was a freelance writer was basically just to say that I, like, skipped lunch every day and periodically pitched articles. Like, I had to make enough money to live and was not in putting myself in a position to ever make enough money to live. And then things started to get better for me. I got better as a writer. I got a little more responsible. I started drinking less and, like, just in general realized that it would be what I want to say yes to as opposed to whatever was floating through my mind at a given moment. But those, all the bad habits I picked up as a freelancer, which were all of them based in that sort of constant low thrum of anger. Because, and if people don't say yes, you don't get, you know, you don't get paid. And if you don't get paid, then she doesn't get paid and whatever. I mean, like, I was never going to wind up on the street, but I was, you know, definitely not going to make any money unless people said yes to my shit. And that made me very, it sort of really dovetailed with a lot of parts of my personality, a lot of instincts that are the less healthy and less productive, helpful, whatever, instincts that I have. And I found it very hard, I've still found it very hard to shake that. I mean, the idea of like staying up late working or whatever, you know, with The Classical, I didn't need to do that necessarily, but I wanted to give SB Nation, you know, their 8 or 10 hours that they were paying me for. And then I wanted to give the people that wanted to have their stuff run at The Classical the attention that I believe they deserved. And I wanted to do a good job for the site because people gave us money, you know, on Kickstarter to do a good job with it. And yeah, I mean, I just wound up sort of taking that out of my own end. And I still do that. And, you know, that the idea of motivating through guilt is not, it's not healthy, but, you know, can't argue with the results. Like, it definitely did get me. That's what got me those last 3 hours every day, was feeling like I owed it to somebody. And, you know, and that I would be letting them down and letting other people down if I didn't do it.
And yeah, if guilt didn't work, Catholicism would have been totally gone years ago. Like, it just...
Yeah, right. This is, I mean, you know, whatever. Reformed Judaism is kind of the same thing, right? I mean, yeah. Culturally, we're all in some sort of belief. There's an angry God that's like, oh, I noticed that. Like, and whatever your faith, whatever your God looks like, not the most forgiving of characters.
Well, no, mine is now Kickstarter backers. Like, that is my new God.
I know, backers. Which, and that was, I'd love to hear your opinion on this, too, because the people I worked with, I think everybody had different takes on it, and everybody worked real hard to, like, get everyone their T-shirts and get all the pledges fulfilled and everything like that. I had a really hard time feeling like I was giving everybody value on this, because I could not believe that people that I didn't know dollars to this website because they wanted to read the shit that we were going to do. Like, how do you reconcile, like, guilt on your end? I'm curious.
I don't have a good answer for that
question. I don't know that I have one either, and our campaign was, like, 46 years ago or whatever at this point, so.
Yeah, I mean, I have...
Well, if you're not, I'll give you a call.
I still owe a few people a few things from a campaign from the last fall. Part of why I haven't done it yet is I want to do what they are owed just right. Like, some of the stuff they're, like, I'm doing the actual thing that was funded. Like, that's going well. But I put some specific, like, I'll do this weird thing for you. And now I'm like, oh, I want to do that in a certain way. But they don't even have a real expectation of, like, I think I've created in my own head a impossible objective, which I think is a thing you do so that you never feel satisfied, so that you keep doing more stuff, so it's somehow good, but...
Yeah. It is tough, though, because there's no... That's a hamster wheel, you know?
Yeah.
I know that feeling very, very well, and it's tough because you can... In all the ways that you can sort of recognize that you're being unfair to yourself or that you're moving the goalposts on yourself, you know, that essentially, that, you know, it's punitive. And it's punitive without any real end, you know, in mind. It's a lot easier to understand that in a, you know, sort of in an intellectual way than it is to emotionally make it real enough to alter your behavior.
Yeah, because it's really also like narcissism. You're like,
yeah, the idea that everybody cares about
me. Yeah, no.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, that's true. I think also we are conditioned with, you know, the idea of like creative work. You know, that when I... You know, thinking of the crappy temp jobs I had, or thinking of I had a job at, you know, when I was in college, just resurfacing the parking lot at a strip mall in Lincoln Park, New Jersey.
That's
like,
pretty
in that case,
rich.
Like, it was, I knew exactly what I was getting paid for, though, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, it was one of those things where, like, this is the going rate for, like, the sweaty guy pushing a bunch of freaking driveway ceiling around. Poorly.
And at the end of the day, you knew if you had done the work or not, because there was more stuff sealed.
And I think with, right. And it's not like, you know, I think that this is, you know, we risk drawing too, you know, I think, skating like a line around the work that we actually do. And there's many, I'm working. I'm not like sitting. I'm not outdoors. But
no.
Like the parts of my brain that people are contracted to, you know, buy that labor for money with, like those parts are in action. But with creative stuff, I think that we tend to think of it because it's the sort of thing that we might be doing for free if we had, I mean, like, I would be writing if I had a regular job. You know, I don't know that I'd be writing as much, but this is the thing that I like. You know, this is the thing that I've liked since I was in high school. And knowing that it's like, there's this, the proximity of the pleasure of it, and then the actual fact that it's my work now, has like, that's another thing to sort of negotiate that I've always sort of had some problems with, because it's like, when it works right, it's fun. And then, you know, you kind of like can't believe that someone's paying you for it, but it's not ever, you know, in order to be like successful at it, you really do need to be extremely businesslike and to make these really cold business-minded decisions about like, what are you going to, you know, cut bait on? What are you going to not write about because there's no money in it? You know, whatever. It's,
yeah, you have to shift from getting to do it to having to do it in order to make
right.
it sustainable.
And I sort of need to be in that former headspace in order to do it the way that I want to do it, in order to do the actual work. You know, that like I need to be I need to feel open and sort of creative when I'm doing it. And yet I need to be, and this is something I'm sure, you know, that as an editor that I've had a harder time with, just in terms of saying yes into the pitches, that like I have, you know, you have to be a different sort of, you have to be your own manager in a certain way. And yet you also have to, you know, that's a difficult sort of switch from one side of the brain to the other, or it can be.
Well, so let me,
we're probably better at it than me, but
no, not at all. You're the best. Is that
nice to know?
Is that helpful?
Yeah, very much.
Let me talk about the brain switch, another kind of brain switch. Are you able to just enjoy your experience of watching a game or watching an event and not thinking about how it would fit into a story or thinking about how you'll do the work of writing about it?
Yes, I'm lucky to be able to do that because I don't have to write as much. I think the guys that have, and you can see it too. I mean, I think once a columnist or, you know, even somebody that's following a team around burns out on it, like, you don't come back from that. And at least, you know, the rigor of the pace of that job doesn't allow you to. And then when you can tell when you're reading somebody that doesn't like sports anymore and they're writing about sports, I mean, it is just fucking sour. And it's so, like, you know, like dark and involuted and like just not the way that I want to write about this stuff. And I feel like I need to, that's an instance where like I need to watch a game and enjoy it. I need to watch it like and like be on Twitter or have a drink or like have it be way outside of the context of the work that I'm doing, because if I don't, and if I'm thinking about it as the sort of thing I'm supposed to be taking notes on or whatever, then like then I'm never off the clock, you know, like I'm not, I mean, they're just disaster. But I'm lucky that I have, you know, as much work as I do, that like the pace of the work allows for that. I think that people that are on, you know, a beat with a team, you know, that like follow, like whatever, you follow the for 162 games.
Yeah,
and you're tweeting about them, and you're, yeah, right. I mean, and the stuff that's required of those guys now too. I mean, it's not just like a game story and a preview or whatever. It's like they need to be blogging, they need to be tweeting, they need to be doing mailbags and whatever. I don't know how anybody could like baseball enough. I mean, let alone how depressing the Mets are for me to just watch 5 nights.
Right.
The idea of doing that and, you know, just being there all along for it, like it just seems so exhausting and so punishing that, I, you know, like, whatever. I'd love to think there was a different way to do it. I'm just lucky that I don't have to. I don't think I have the focus to do it, but I'm also, I don't know that I have at this point, like the will that's required.
Do you have like writers, sports writers or other writers that you looked up to, or even you found yourself initially aping the style of, like when you were a teenager or a young adult?
You know, I really want to write at those ages. Like I wanted to, I read about it a lot. But I mean, I wanted to be a novelist or to be, you know, a short story writer or something.
Hmm.
I think also too that, you know, like once my first job after I graduated was at AOL, just doing this like really sort of drony content. But that was around when like Bill Simmons was starting to break through with ESPN. I remember reading his stuff at work and being like sort of startled that anybody could write like that. You know, that he was allowed to get away with it, that it wasn't this kind of like mock heroic, old timey, you know, sort of retrograde stuff. And then it wasn't that like very polished Sports Illustrated feature style.
Yeah, it had more voice in it.
Yeah. And it's funny, like, I don't think that he, as a writer, you know, he's had a wonderful career as a guy with big ideas who's able to execute them. And, you know, he's done a lot of really good work. As a writer, I don't think he's improved really at all. I think he's kind of, and I don't, because it's whatever, he doesn't care too. I mean, that's fine. He doesn't,
no,
this is a guy that never had pretensions to, yeah, right, which is like, that's also a really important thing to do. And like, the idea that, I mean, for me, like, I have a different set of things that I aspire to or whatever, but that style of it, that was, I think, the one, which is weird because he's not a guy that I list among the writers that I find, you know, to be influential on me or whatever, that was the one that first, I think, really made me sit up and take notice, the idea that you could, like, sort of write about sports in the way that you would talk about sports as opposed to do it in this kind of, like, third generation dub of how everybody had already done it, but like maybe you're trying to get in a couple of like extra grandiose statements or whatever. I mean, it was just all so purple and that deflated it so much. And I think that there's like now, you know, whatever, the proliferation of places to write about it has sort of ensured that there's also all these different ways to write about it. There's a lot of people that write about stuff now that, I mean, just in terms of the people that were co-founders of mine at the Classical, that Bethlehem Scholes, Nathaniel, and the whole Free Darko thing, writing about basketball, and the way that Tim Marchman wrote about, covered the Yankees and the Mets for a terrible paper in New York called The New York Sun, that, like, all of that stuff, just reading that, in all those cases, there's this sort of, like, shock of seeing something done in a new way by people that are clearly very smart. And that sort of, like, seems, it resonates all the more because it's something that you haven't experienced before. Even if I was never, I don't think that I ever committed to that whole, like, there's a whole philosophical underpinning to the Free Darko blog that Nathaniel and Eric Freeman, who's another one of the Classical co-founders, like, all those guys have this sort of, like, intellectual superstructure for the way that they thought about that stuff. And I never fully bought into it. You know, like, I never, they were more teams. Like, I always cared about the team that I cared about. Even without that, it was just, there's something kind of cool about it. And I think the whole process of me reading and writing has always been about this, that, like, you know, I grew up in a suburb in New Jersey. Everybody kind of dressed the same. It was all, like, a very normal place. And I looked and acted and dressed like everybody else there. And then every now and then you get this sort of hint of a bigger world or, like, a different way of seeing things or understanding them or caring about them. And in all of those cases, I mean, it's just like, it's a head rush. It's awesome. I'm still not, I mean, that's the thing that I look for in everything. Still.
To chase that different approach?
Yeah, or just something that, like, because at this point, with many of the stories, especially, like, with sports and stuff like that, there's only so many things to say that haven't already been said about, like, LeBron James has written about more than just that human that's not or and there's only so many new ways to see him or to write about him. And yet, like, that doesn't mean that it's boring to watch him. That just means that we haven't figured out all the different ways to sort of, like, explain and enjoy, really more enjoy that. And so that's, yeah, I mean, in all of those instances, the same way that I'm, you know, the writers that have moved me outside of the sports fan, just thinking about George Saunders is one that comes to mind. That, like, as a guy that, I just remember reading some of his stories before he was, like, bigger. He's big, you know, he's in the New Yorker and stuff. You get used to kind of, like, reading the first three paragraphs of a fiction thing in the New Yorker, and you're like, oh, it's an unhappy marriage, cool, like, onto the movies. And
I've read that same article so many times.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I mean, it's funny, they're all very professionally done, and the writers are really good and everything like that, but, my God, one more, like, floundering academic marriage in a, like, just whatever, like, infidelity
they're,
and, like,
sublimated cruelty. But their infant hauntingly died.
Sad when you think about it.
And they've never gotten past it.
There's one story, and it's funny, I love Sam Shepard as a writer and as an actor. He wrote a short story for them that was like a parody of a New Yorker short story that was not at all a parody. It's like an unhappy marriage, everybody's drunk, a bird flies down the chimney, and the man kills it because a bird's not supposed to be in the house. And it was so dark and so grim, and yet at the same time, you're like, oh, I wonder if the bird represented anything. I wonder why they're, like, why about it coming down the chimney? That's interesting, that it would let itself into the house unbidden. All right. But, like, after I read that, I was sort of like, I don't need to fuck with this anymore. Like, I'm going to be dead in a few decades. And, like, whatever amount of time I'm spending with this particular imaginary divorce, like, I don't need to be a part of. But, yeah, Saunders is the guy you'd read the first few paragraphs of. What are you doing here? And that in itself, even, you know, I don't always love everything that he writes. I think fiction is far superior to the nonfiction, and, you know, nobody's perfect all the time, but there's something startling about it consistently. There can be something very startling about it that I find really bracing.
I think he does some things that shouldn't work as a writer, and
oh yeah,
and
sure.
Often they do, and that's somehow exciting. This should not come together the way that it's coming together. Because it's more risk.
When it works, you're just sort of like, all right, so there's a ghost now or something. These crazy choices that, like, are, I don't know, it's cool. But you try it, honestly. I mean, it has that kind of, like, segue all the way back to the Olympics or whatever. Now, like, there's a video that got circulated on the internet. It was actually from the 2012 Olympics. It was a Filipino diving team.
So the belly, the backflop guy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was... amazing, and I love it, and I probably watched it 200,000 times.
Yeah.
The thing that I'm curious about with them is, so they get up there, they've been practicing, right? Like, they know what's going to happen. And they, so they get up there on the table, and they're like, I'm going to do it. Like, I'm going to do, like, a fucking triple twist, and I'm going to land it perfectly, even though I have never done that. I know very well that this is the first time that I ever do it, and I know that I'm on, everybody's watching, but here we go. And then they just go up there and wipe the fuck out and get to the floor. They're like, oh. And they high-five each other and get 0.0s. But, like, the thought process, there's something very heroic to me about that guy stepping up on that diving board and knowing that he's going to try to do something that he has zero chance of landing. And yet, like, you know, that's the gig. So, like, gotta do it.
That feels way more brave than, I have been the best runner or swimmer in the world. Now I'm going to go continue to do that. That's amazing, too. But the stakes aren't as high because you are, everyone expects you to, like, that's a lot of pressure. But this guy who's like, I've literally never done this. But I've sure tried, and so I'm going to go try again, like that.
I think it's wonderful. The other funny thing, I think this is something I wrote about last year. One of my favorite things that's ever been committed to video is a guy attempting a dunk in the Chinese Basketball League's dunk contest at All-Star Weekend. And he lined up five adults from the just inside the foul line to the basket. They're all standing, like, basically, they're all facing in the same direction, and they're basically, they're, you know, chest to back. And he seemed to think that he was going to jump over all five of these adults, go soaring over their heads like Evel Knievel over freaking Snake River Canyon, and dunk. And if he'd done it, it would have been the most amazing thing that anyone had ever seen. Because, like, when Dwight Howard jumps over one person, or Nate Robinson jumps over one person, actually, I guess it was Nate Robinson, like, that was amazing. This guy was going to try to jump over five, and he's just, like, some spindly dude from the Chinese Basketball Association. And, of course, he did not do it. And, like, jumped, drove his pelvis into the back of the head of the guy that was standing at the back of the stack. They all go down like dominoes. But, like, there's something very brave about attempting to do something that stupid that I cannot help but admire and relate.
Yeah, well, can you pinpoint anything you've done with your work where you felt like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to pull this off? Like, maybe not to the degree where you end up with your pelvis in someone's head, but
I was sure that I was going to end up wiping out that on a bunch of things because I didn't go to journalism school. You know, like, I don't really fundamentally trust my ability to do a lot of this stuff. I can write a sentence, you know, and I can watch a basketball game and I can write a sentence about watching the basketball game. But, like, I'm not a great reporter. Like, I have zero instincts. Like, I'm not bad at it. I've taught myself to do it. You know, I'm old and I've been doing this for some time, but it's, when I was at SB Nation, they sent me to Qatar, the country, 2022 World Cup, and it was one of the best things I ever got to do, and I think the work that I did there, I wrote a five-part thing, and I think it's probably the best thing I ever wrote, just in terms of as a full spectrum, longer than, you know, I've, like, written columns that I enjoyed more, but that was one where I put in your, but they sent me there, it was basically my boss, some column about how screwed up it was that Qatar was cutting corners on this, all the labor standards, and that workers are dying, they're trying to build these stadiums, why do they even have the World Cup anyway, whatever. And, you know, whatever, I wrote, like, a totally righteous column from my couch, like, literally from my couch, I was probably wearing slippers at the time, you know, just, like, easy as pie. And then my editor asked me, like, a week later, he's like, hey, do you want to go to Qatar? Like, do you want to actually, like,
would you like to put your money where your mouth is?
Hilarious bluff call, like, absolutely what he was doing. I mean, just sort of being like, or would you rather, like, stay at home and, like, write about this video of an ostrich running down a street that you found and that you've convinced yourself is sports? And, like, in my heart, the answer is, like, I would probably prefer to write about the ostrich because it's much easier. Like, I've already got my slippers on. Why would I leave? And, yeah, like, I went, and I was, I think, you know, well outside my comfort zone. The piece of it's not perfect, obviously, you know? Like, there's a lot of stuff I didn't get. And there's no way that you could tell a whole story about anything in, you know, whatever, five chunks or however. But, yeah, I mean, that was hard, and I didn't know if I was going to do a good job of it, and I think I did do a good job of it, and I was very proud to have even attempted it. I think a lot of what I do with the columns and stuff, there's times where I'm trying to make a complicated point or a point that, like, I want to make that I need to sort of, like, and being instrumental with the sports to use it to make that point. And that's not always the coolest thing in the world, and you know, to the extent that it's hard, it's because I'm making it hard. It's because I'm choosing not to actually write about the thing I'm supposed to write about, because, like, what I really want to do is write about the election or some stupid other thing. But yeah, I mean, that was definitely one where, you know, I felt pushed, and I think that then I was able to respond to it. The
do
thing
you feel
about
like
getting
that,
better with the stuff, like, you
yeah,
need
you
that.
Think that
and
changed
I,
your work?
Yeah. I mean, I think it changed my approach to it. I think certainly it makes you more humble. I mean, like, I do my best not to pretend to be an expert about things, just because there's things that I know stuff about, and I'll speak on them with as much authority as I feel like I have, but I feel like pretending to know more than that is, sure, not just to make yourself look like an idiot, but to just sort of, like, there's a whole series of conclusions at the end of that particular road that I don't really want to reach, you know, like, I don't want to become the sort of person that believes himself to be an expert. And in that case, there's something about being so kind of like, it's so humbling, you know, to be in this place that is so different, where you don't know what's going on, and nobody's really inclined to tell you what's going on. You're not going to be able to figure it out for yourself. And just like, so you are very, very aware of how little you know. And that was, I think, that was a good sort of reminder of the fact that like oomph I put into my column about how like messed up Cutter was, that like, that was less earned, I think,
yeah,
and less fully understood than I thought it was. Because I read like 3 Guardian articles and a, you know, whatever, the pressy, but not the entire version of an Amnesty International report. Like, and like, of course.
Yeah, the perspective thing. Well, so kind of like a wrap up-y question. Do you have thoughts on goals? Like, do you have a place you're trying to get to? And I don't mean like, you know, what's your 5-year plan? I don't know what that even means, but do you have some focus of your ambition?
That's a really good question. I think the answer, well, it's a good question to me, because it's something I think about. I don't know if anybody else would care about my wish to write a novel or something like that. But like, yeah, I have my goal right now. The near term one is to try to figure out what my goals are. I think that I get in this kind of, and I've been in it for so long. I mean, going back to before the class rule, you know, when I was freelancing as hard as I was, you get in this kind of fog of war approach to work, you know, where I'm constantly doing stuff. There's constantly open tabs and people that need something from me and that I don't want to let down and whatever. And in that case, I mean, I can do all that stuff. I've like trained myself and gotten into that sort of weird, it's like the opposite of physical fitness, but I mean, the idea of like being able to turn all that around. But there is something about living that way that forecloses the sort of broader goal-making stuff. Like, I mean, I'm lucky in the sense that, like, I have a nice home. I love my wife. My friends and family are nearby. Like, I don't want to change a lot in my actual life. But I would love to have more space to do, you know, and this is something that you know, my work is encouraged, too, to do more stuff like either, like, the Cutter thing or whatever. I mean, I love writing the column, but I'd love to see, to get outside of the sort of writing in your slippers mode that I can be in. It's not that I don't like it. I do like it. I think that I could probably do other stuff, and I have not really had the chance to do that. I'd love to write a book. I'd love to do an anthology of the best classical stuff, just because I'm so proud of what we were able to do, and there's so much stuff that I would love to be able to. Finally, I'd also love to really be able to pay these writers. So many of them wrote stuff for free, you know, all this fantastic shit. If we actually had a book, then I would be able to give them money from that.
Yeah.
I mean, with all of that, it's just, I kind of start thinking about it, and I don't know, it always feels like a bunch of swell ideas that I don't have the time for. And I think the first goal is to try to figure out a way to organize my life such that I can think structurally in that way and see, you know, what it is I really want to do, as opposed to just coming through the finish line at the end of another day or of another week, secure that I did like a decent job.
Like, move from just keep moving to focusing on going in a certain direction or
exactly. And I think that's a lot of whatever. It's not, you don't have to be like somebody trying to do like creative stuff in order to feel that way. I mean, it's just that what sort of the conditions of working life put on you. I mean, I do a lot of it to myself, but there's something very frustrating about that. And I get frustrated more for like sort of allowing it to happen. But it's like I create the circumstances for myself to be working so much that I can't think about anything but work. And that's
right.
So that's the part I would really like to fix. And then in terms of the goals beyond that, like, yeah, I mean, I'd obviously love to write more. I'd love to do all kinds of things. But it's first things first, right? Like, I have to sort of get my head straight.
I think that's a solid goal to
figure. I mean, The solid goal is to figure out some things that you may want. That's a. I should put that on a T-shirt or get it tattooed on my forearm so that every time I look down at it, I'll know. You should try to start thinking about ways to think about things.
Yeah. Well, you got to first figure out like when you're going to get the tattoo and make a whole plan. And
right. And I'm very busy. We're going away next week. This is what I'm saying. This is why it's been so difficult. What's why I've lived so long and have not gotten even one tattoo.
Right.
Embarrassing, really, when you think about it that way.
That's a deathbed thing. You'll just quick give me a tattoo. I just want to check this off.
That's what it's all about. It's tough, though, because I don't know if I don't want to be in, like, you know, in my 70s getting a lower back tattoo.
Well, and then you can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery, right? So that's its own layer of complexity to that, too.
Actually, I need to wait until my parents pass. I'm getting a tattoo.
So you do have a plan.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's it. That's my long-term goal, basically, is to get – I hope my parents live a really long time, basically. My sister has two very teethful tattoos. My mom still makes faces out of it. Like,
oh, boy.
Not very backward-thinking people in any other way, but they
– No, there's a
very artfully
thing.
Rendered raspberry on her arm, and I was like, oh, come on. What are you, Tommy Lee now from Motley Crue?
I already had a tattoo, and my wife's family found out I was going to get another tattoo, and my father-in-law wrote me a very thoughtful, long email about, you know, what to consider and how it changes people's perceptions, and I was like, you know, I already have one of these. Like, that part,
were you planning on getting it on your throat or something? Like,
it was a full face, like a full, just, I thought I'd get the text of the Great Gatsby on my face, but...
It's beautiful.
No, it's totally discreet. It was just a weird, like... There's a certain age of a lot of folks, I'm speaking in broad terms, who are still like, that's what sailors have. You know, like, I don't know what the baggage is. But I'm glad we're ending on tattoo talk.
Yeah, this is good. I feel like we can, if we do a sequel here, we just go start with Allen Iverson, and then we could probably do another hour and a half.
Yeah. Where can people find you? You have several places, but where's the best place to read your old stuff, keep up with what you're doing now, and then connect with you in general?
On Twitter is where I spam most of my things, so that's @David_J_Roth. And then most of the stuff everything that I write at this point is on Vice Sports. I used to have when I was freelancing, I had a website where I'd put links to all my stuff, but I let that lapse, and I believe that actually it's been taken over as a spam legal site, so don't go to David Roth, the writer. .com. You go to davidroththewriter.blogspot.com and you can see what that looked like the last time I updated it in 2011. But the classical.
If we need legal advice,
if you want really bad legal advice, like if you want to get a reverse mortgage, probably a scam. davidroththewriter.com. If you want to read old freelance stuff and bloggy stuff, davidroththewriter.blogspot.com. Okay. But yeah, sports.advice.com is the thing, and the classical.org. I haven't written much there recently, but you can still find something.
Cool. Well, I really appreciate you spending the time to talk to me.
That was great fun to do, dude. I really appreciate you asking. Thank you.